You only put that they're Anglican on their census form. You're wrong, because Anglicans never sit in the front row in any form. And so you better race back and scribble it out, or you'll be up for perjury or something. What happens when you lie on the census form? I don't know. If they catch you, you're in trouble. Moya filled ours out. They won't be able to read it. She's got the questions wrong here. I think Luke was her husband, and scribbled all over things everywhere. Well, we're back to the book of Job, so turn to that, if you would. And I suspect that for most of us here, I don't have to remind you the importance of what we're doing, but I will remind you, because it's so important, that when we open the Bible and understand its message, that God himself is speaking to us. People often wonder how God can communicate with them and do all sorts of things to find out the truth about God, and they meditate and they daydream and they look inside themselves to try and find God. It's very simple, really. God speaks to us. God can speak to us any way he wants to, of course. And if God speaks to you in some blinding flash, well, come and share that with us sometimes, if that ever happens to you. But I know that God is consistently, regularly speaking to people when people open the Bible and read it, and when the Bible's being taught. That's what God's doing. He's promised to do it. If we're prepared to listen, we'll hear what God has to say to us. And so that's what we're setting our minds to doing. And of course, we must pray that God will help us to do it. So let's pray. Our great God, we thank you that you've spoken, that you've caused the words you want us to hear to be written in the scriptures. And thank you that as we read the Bible now, and as we think about its message, this great book, the book of Job, help us to understand. Help us to understand properly. And help us to understand that the things that we hear are not human words, but the words that are written here, you have spoken and you speak to us. So help us to hear your voice in that way. Tonight, Father, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Book of Job. The outline of our study is on the sheet you've got. I hope you've got the sheet. Anyone not got one? Okay. Let me remind you where we were last time, or if you weren't here, to bring you up to date. We looked at the first two chapters, or most of the first two chapters of the book of Job last time. There were five themes there, which presented us with the situation that is the situation that is explored in the book that follows. We met Job. The godly man Job. Man who's actually a model of godliness. A man whose trust in God is a very model of what trust in God ought to be. His life is a life of obedience to God. He's such a man that he's described in verse 1 of chapter 1 as blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He is, this is a bit anachronistic of course, but he is the model Christian. Now, he's not a Christian, he's an Old Testament man, he doesn't know about Jesus directly, but he is the model of what a person who knows God ought to be like at the beginning of the book. That's what he's like. Remember the other thing we learned about him at the beginning of the book? He was not only that, but he was also blessed by God. He was blessed by God. That is to say, he enjoyed a good life, and the good things in God's world he enjoyed in great abundance. And you remember we noticed last time that as the book opens, that seems to be very appropriate. And unlike many moments in life, you don't ask why. Why should this man Job be enjoying such a good life? It seems appropriate that a man of such godliness, who so trusts God, that such a man should be blessed by God. Now, much of the time in life, it isn't like that. You see, people who have no regard for God may get on very well indeed, remarkably well, better than you or I seem to be able to manage. And we say, why? Why should they get all the good things and we miss out? After all, they disregard God, take no notice of God. Here am I struggling to be a faithful Christian, and I'm not enjoying half the things that they're enjoying. Or it can work the other way around. You can see a person who, maybe yourself, you may be somebody that you see, that you know and love, who is a fine person, a person of integrity, and perhaps a person of Christian faith, and they suffer enormously. You say, why are they suffering? And there's a question why. But at the beginning of the book of Job, there's no question why. Come on in. Better late than never, any time. Good to have you. Here at the beginning of the book of Job, we've only just started anyway. And we're going over last week, so there you are. Come in and have a seat. At the beginning of the book of Job, there's no tension, there's no inappropriateness there. It's like that. But then you remember we took a look behind the scenes, so to speak. We were taken behind the scenes into heaven, in fact, where a very profound question was asked. A challenge was raised. And the challenge was this. Grasp it, because I think that this is really the heart of what the whole book of Job is going to be about. The challenge was, is a life like Job's, a man who trusts in God deeply, is that really a good thing? Or isn't it merely selfishness in the end? Isn't he simply a selfish man because he trusts in God, because he reckons God will keep rewarding him and God will keep looking after him? Conversation I had afterwards last Sunday night sharpened my thinking about this. The question is not, is trust in God selfish, but is it merely selfish? Now the question that is asked by Satan in this case of God, Satan says, isn't he just a selfish man? He trusts in God, and that his trust in God is pure selfishness. It's purely because God, he reckons God will look after him and God keeps giving him good things, and so there you see a godly man. Isn't godliness, isn't trust in God, isn't the Christian life, isn't being Christian, really in the end, simply selfish? You're doing it simply for yourself because you're hopeful that God will look after you, you are doing it simply for what you're going to get out of it. Well, you remember that in that opening scenes, God accepted that challenge. And God in this book is setting out to demonstrate that that is not the case. And that faith in God is not, at least not necessarily, mere selfishness. And you remember what happened? You remember that Job was in fact stripped of all his possessions. He lost his family, at least all but his wife. Not quite sure whether he's pleased about that or not. And he himself, at the end of where we got to last time, was sitting on a rubbish tip outside the town, dreadfully suffering physically, having lost everything. Everything that he'd ever owned or loved is lost. And he's sitting on the rubbish tip outside the town, scratching his broken sores with a piece of old china or something. And saying, do you remember the words? Down at the end of verse chapter 2 and verse 10, the end of verse 10, shall we accept good from God and not trouble too? He trusts in God at that point. Now, that situation is the setting for a great discussion that's going to go on through the rest of this book, a great discussion of the big issues of life. What we have before us, sketched in this scene at the opening two chapters, is an example of outstanding suffering. Job suffered like I reckon no person has ever suffered. Before or since, barring only Jesus on the cross, I suspect. His suffering is everything, right? Personal, physical torture, he is suffering. Loss of loved ones, loss of friends, he's an outcast, he's out of the town in which he lives. He has lost all his, he has lost everything, he has suffered everything, he is suffering everything that a person can suffer. This is outstanding suffering, this is extraordinary suffering. And in the midst of that situation, you see a man who has an outstanding trust in God. He trusts in God. Now that raises very big questions. The big questions of life, as we'll see as we go on, are raised when you witness suffering. Well, we come now to what's scene 6 in chapter 2. We haven't quite finished chapter 2, so we'll go back to there and pick it up in chapter 2, verse 11. For here we meet the other main characters in this book. They come onto the stage. Chapter 2, verse 11. You got it? I'll read it. Then Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, got nothing to do with his, you know, Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him. And they set out from their homes to meet together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him, and they began to weep aloud. They tore their robes, sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. It seems that Job was a man of very great importance in his day. of international importance. These three characters come from three different countries round about. There's Eliphaz from the country of Teman, and Bildad from Shuhar, and Zophar from Naamah. I don't know where those three places are, but they're three different countries. And these three characters come from there, and they come by they make arrangements with one another to come and to comfort Job, to sympathize with him. His calamity is so great that word is spread far and wide of this man's enormous tragedy, his enormous suffering. And as they approach, you notice they can hardly recognize him. There's just a light touch telling you something about the depth of what he has gone through. Is he now a gaunt, haggard figure? They can hardly recognize him. He has gone through so much since they last saw him. His suffering has been so great that his friends cannot recognize him. And they react with signs of grief themselves. The tragedy that has struck Job spills over to them. If you've sat with somebody who's suffering, have you yourself witnessed suffering? Some of us will have, some of us won't have really witnessed deep suffering. Have you sat with somebody who's dying of cancer? Some of you will have done that. Some of you will know someone you love. If you come near a person who's deeply suffering, the suffering somehow spills over, doesn't it? And it touches you. And so these three friends, they weep. They weep aloud just being in the presence of such suffering, such loss, such grief, such tragedy, as was Job's. And they weep and they sit there silent. Don't be too quick to be cynical, and don't be too quick to criticize these three friends. They sit there in silence for 7 days. I can't think of anything more that they could have done at that point. For there is suffering, and when you encounter suffering of this kind and of this magnitude, I think it's often the case that there just isn't anything to be said. They've come to sympathize with him, but what can they say? What can you say when you witness suffering like this? Well, for 7 days, they sit in silence. At the end of the 7 days, it's Job who breaks the silence with that powerful outburst that Arthur read to us earlier on. He cries out and he curses the day of his birth. Let me just read you the first verses 3 and 4 there of chapter 3. Job opens his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Verse 2, he said, "May the day of my birth perish. And the night it was said a boy is born, that day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it." Verse 5. "May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night, may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year. Get all your calendars and the day that I was born on, cross it out. Don't remember it. Cursed be that day. The worst day in history as far as I'm concerned," says Job. "I wish the day had never been. I wish that I had never been born." Now, I'm going to come back next week and have a look more closely at Job's reaction in chapter 3 and in other places in the book next week. But let me just draw your attention to what he says in this chapter. He curses the day of his birth. "If only I had never been born," he says. And then as the chapter goes on, you come down to verse 11, he says, "Well, if I had to be born, why didn't I die at birth? Why didn't I perish at birth and die as I came from the womb?" He goes on and thinks about that for a little while, and he gets down to verse 20. He says, "Why should life be like this? Why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul?" He's crying out with great passion. Now, you could be cold and calculating and look at Job and say, well, here's a cry of great self-pity. But for goodness sake, who can blame him? You got any idea what he's going through, what he's been through, what his suffering is? Job is not a hunk of rock. He's a human being. And he cries out with the torment that he's experiencing. Now, friends, this is what suffering does, isn't it? When suffering is significant in life, suffering puts an enormous question mark over life. What is good about life? Now, many people, some of you are in the medical profession here, will be able to testify to us, perhaps, of your experience of first encountering deep suffering. I have a good number of friends, Christian friends, who have gone into nursing or medicine or doctoring or whatever, and one of the most difficult things for them to come to grips with were to believe in God, to trust in God as they had over the years, and then to come to see day after day after day suffering, real intense suffering, dreadful suffering, tragic suffering, suffering that just rips your heart apart. How can it be? How can life be good when life is like this? Now that's what Job's saying. How can life be good when it's like this? What good can there be about life when life is like this? Now, some of us will have to do a fair bit in our imagination, because life's been pretty cushy up to this point and we haven't encountered suffering very much. But you know how protected we've been if that's the case. You know that this world is full of it, don't you? I haven't known it much in my own life. I've witnessed suffering a little from time to time in others. From time to time it's touched me in people close to me. But I have to say, I can't speak to you personally about real suffering. I don't think I've been there yet. I suspect I will be much more there before my life is out, and so will the rest of us. Because this world is full of it. It is, as I think I said last week, quoting the words of someone that I heard, this world is a sea of suffering. And yes, we happen to be in a small minority in the Western world, in the prosperous part of the world that happen to be reasonably protected from suffering, and we manage to cushion ourselves from it some of the time. But even for us, it penetrates our cushion. And suffering, heartache, pain, trouble, whatever words you want to use, touch us. And touch us deeply. And the big question mark comes over life. What is good about it? Wouldn't it be better if it were not, when life is like this? And that's what Job's got to. He's got to that point. And he's saying, it would have been better if I'd never been born, if this is what life is like. Why should anyone live if life is like this? Now think. What would you say to such a person? Now, after all, we're Christian people. We've got the Bible. We know God. We know truths about God. We know what God is like. What would you say? Surely we have something to say. I'm not asking you to answer this at the moment. Just think about it. What would you say to a person who is suffering as Job is suffering and is crying out as Job is crying out? Now, what we're going to do tonight is listen to the kind of things that those three friends said to Job, and think about what they said, and try and learn from what they say, and assess what kind of counselors they ended up being, what kind of friends they ended up being to him. The first of them to speak is Eliphaz. And his speech is in chapters 4 and 5. And what we're going to do now, really, I'm going to ask you to listen with me as we listen to the various friends speak, think about what they say briefly, and then we're going to try and assess what they say. Is it good? Is it helpful? If it's good, why is it good? If it's not helpful, why is it not helpful? Okay? Well, Eliphaz, he begins rather sympathetically, tactfully, politely. I think he's a bit nervous. I don't know many things that scare me more than trying to speak to somebody who is really suffering. I think Eliphaz is a bit nervous to start with. He gets his courage later on, more's the pity. But he starts off a little nervously and cautiously. And he says, I'm reading chapter 4, verse 2. This is the words of Eliphaz to Job. If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? But who can keep from speaking? Think now. Think how you have instructed me. How you've strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You've strengthened faltering knees. But now trouble comes to you and you're discouraged. It strikes you and you are dismayed. Should not your piety be your confidence and your blameless ways your hope? What are you saying? He's saying to Job, think about your past life, Job. In the past, Job had apparently given comfort and help and advice to many people who had been suffering. And indeed, it seems that his counsel and his help and his encouragement had been a strength to many people. And so Eliphaz gently rebukes Job. Does Job's present distress mean that he cannot apply to himself what he preached to others? He's gently reminding Job that his past godly life really ought to give him resources to cope with the present. He preached to others. Can't he save himself? Can you remember those words? Well, Eliphaz goes on then, having gained a little bit of confidence, to assert his basic theory about life. Comes in verses 7 to 9, chapter 4. Consider now, he says, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plough evil and those who sow trouble reap it. At the breath of God they are destroyed. At the blast of his anger they perish. As Eliphaz has looked around life, his observation has been, his conclusion has been, that trouble comes to those who deserve it. That's what he reckons. A man reaps what he sows, says elsewhere in the Bible. And Eliphaz is implying that Job should be encouraged by the fact that if he really is a man of integrity, if he really is a man who trusts in God, if he really is a man who takes God seriously in his life, then he won't perish in the end. He'll be delivered in the end, surely. He focuses Job's attention, you see, on Job's own godly life, Job's own godliness. He says, don't you draw encouragement from your own godliness as you think back? Surely you are the kind of person that God would deliver. Eliphaz points him in that direction. Well, perhaps in the face of the enormous suffering that Job is going through before his very eyes, perhaps Eliphaz is aware that what he has said is rather bold, and he needs to support what he said. Where has he learnt these things? And so he says he learned them in a dream, actually. From verses 12 down to 19, he tells the dream. We won't pause on that because time's rattling on. He tells him about a dream he had, and in the dream he saw a ghost, and his hair stood up on end, and all these sort of things. It was a great dream. And he heard a quiet voice which said, verse 17, can a mortal man be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, these are the words in the dream, how much more those who live in houses of clay, like us, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth. Think, Job. Think, he says, how frail life is. This is the lesson I learnt in my dream. We are not in a position to question God. We, with our frail lives, we cannot question God. And then in chapter 5, he goes on and draws his conclusions from all this. I'll pick it up in verse 6 of chapter 5. He says, hardship doesn't spring from the soil, nor does trouble sprout from the ground, but paradoxically, man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. Trouble is just the human's lot, says Eliphaz. That's the way things are, Job. It happens. But, as he said before, don't question God. We're not in a position to question God. This is what Eliphaz is saying. Don't start questioning God, because we're just human beings, frail human beings. What chance have we got to question God? And secondly, draw hope from your godliness. Look back on your life. Don't you see you're the sort of person that God would treat well in the end? Surely you can draw hope from that. Well, he tries to strike now a more cheerful note as he gives his advice to Job in chapter 5, verse 8. Pick it up there. But if it were I, he said, if I were you, dreadful words to speak to someone in Job's position, but that's what he says. If I were you, I would appeal to God. I would lay my cause before him. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. And then he goes on and talks about the great power and the wonderful power of God. Now, he gives advice that I want to suggest to you isn't bad advice. Is it? Is it bad advice to say, put your case to God, put your cause in God's hands, God can do anything? And as Eliphaz winds down his rather lengthy speech, he goes off in a slightly different direction. We'd misjudge Eliphaz if we thought that he was a naive person who thought that only wicked people suffered and good people didn't suffer. He hasn't been really saying that, and he hasn't been implying that, really. He thinks that good people suffer too. He understands that. And so Eliphaz concludes by telling Job how to respond to the troubles of life if they come your way. How to respond in the right spirit. Pick it up in verse 17. He says, blessed is the man whom God corrects. So don't despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. And he goes on and develops that theme right down to the end of the chapter. Now I want you to think with me, is he not saying something true? Is he not saying something that is true about God? It is true that all people suffer. All of us suffer. We usually exaggerate our sufferings. They're not usually, not always, but usually they're not quite as bad as we make out. But we have our little troubles, all of us. And some of us have our very big troubles. We have them, and if God is ruling over the world, surely God's hand is in it. We saw that last time. When you suffer, when I suffer, God is involved in that. You can't say God's not involved in it. God is ruling over everything. God is involved in everything. And what he's saying here is, don't despise what God is doing with you when you're suffering. That's what Alistair says. Don't despise it. For God is a God. Yes, God does wound us. But he also binds us up. God does injure us. But his hands also heal. It's a beautiful picture, really, isn't it? How God deals with us. And I think most of us who've lived any length of time as Christian people will be able to testify that Eliphaz's words are right. Yes, we are hurt at the hands of God, but we are also healed, and God brings good out of suffering. Eliphaz's words are not untrue. If there's any problem with Eliphaz's words, it's not really with their truthfulness. Well, there's the counsel of Eliphaz. Fairly briefly, we've skipped through it. Not quite briefly enough, actually. But Job responds in chapter 6 and 7, and frankly, he's not terribly impressed. In verses 14 and following, I won't read that there, but he says that they're like, Eliphaz's advice has been like water in the desert, a mirage in the desert. Thirsty traveller, longing for some water, longing for some help, longing for some support, and travels towards the mirage and it simply disappears. No help at all. That's how much help Job found from Eliphaz. Well, Eliphaz presumably sits down or whatever he does, fades into the background, and the second of the friends comes forward, Bildad. We meet him, or he comes to speak, in chapter 8. Bildad the Shuhite. He speaks a little more briefly in chapter 8, and he begins a little less politely and gently than Eliphaz had done. There's an impatience in his tone, not quite as tactful as Eliphaz. Starts off by calling Job a windbag in verse 2. How long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. And then he asserts his basic theory about life. Comes in verse 3. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? There it is. Simple as that. God is just. That's my theory of life, says Bildad. That's what I understand to be true. God is just. And as far as Bildad is concerned, that explains life. And everything in life can be fitted into that simple understanding that God is a God who's just. He's got a simple attitude to life, a simple theology, if you like, and he goes on to apply his simple theory of life logically, neatly, but with enormous, no, that's the wrong word, with dreadful shallowness. Dreadful shallowness. Everything, as far as he's concerned in life, can be explained by two kinds of people. Two ways to live, if you like. All screwed up and got wrong. Two kinds of people. The pure and the upright and the wicked. Now, you and I may not be able to distinguish the difference between the pure and the upright and the wicked, says Bildad, but God can. And God distinguishes between them by prospering one lot and destroying the others. God does not pervert justice. What God does is just. So quite coldly, he works out the logic and applies his words to Job's situation. Just listen to it in verse 4. Remember what Job's gone through? Got all in your mind, everything this man's been through? Here's Bildad's words of helpful counsel. When your children sinned against God, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. But if you will look to God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. Your beginnings will seem humble, so prosperous will your future be. All very simple, he says. If you lost your kids, if your kids have all been killed in that dreadful disaster when the house collapsed, if that happened, they must have sinned to deserve it. I don't know whether you've ever heard anybody speak like that. I have. I've actually encountered people, heard people, who see others suffer and have actually said, well, must have sinned. I read a book once by a man who believed something like that. And in the course of his book, he believed that anybody could be healed if they did the right thing, and if they really put their faith in God, people would always be healed, he believed. And the book was an autobiography, and there was one chapter devoted to a discussion of the death of his wife. His wife had died. And it was an enormous problem to him, because his wife was the finest Christian person that he'd ever known. His trust in God was clear and wonderful and beautiful. His love for God was open and wonderful. And in this chapter of the book, he discusses what must have gone wrong. And he works through the chapter and works it all through. It's very sad. At the end of the chapter, he says, there just simply must have been some sin in her life that she didn't know about that was stopping God from healing her. And so she died. And you encounter that kind of thinking. People who think that if you suffer, if you're sick, then there must be some sin in your life that's stopping God from healing you. That's the Bildad's kind of line. You wouldn't suffer unless you deserved it. You wouldn't suffer unless there was some sin in your life. If your kids died, they must have sinned against God, and so that's why they got it in the neck. God is just. That's the truth about life. That's simple enough to explain life, and he explains it that way. Well, as often happens when a person has a fairly weak case, happens with preachers. You listen to me very carefully. The louder I speak, probably the weaker the point will be. So listen very carefully when I start to speak loudly. It's probably because the point is weak. You be discerning to see through that. But the weaker the point, very often the more boldly it's stated. Well, Bildad, having put out this simplistic view of life, appeals to the wisdom of the ages and says, everyone's always known it's been like this. Look at verse 8. Pick it up in verse 8. Ask the former generations and find out what their fathers learned. For we were only born yesterday and know nothing, and our days on earth are but a shadow. Will they not instruct you and tell you? Will they not bring forth words from their understanding? And then, quite remarkably, out of this simple understanding, this simplistic understanding of life, God is just, there springs a rather wonderful statement. For of course the statement God is just is true. Not the whole truth, but it's true. And as he thinks about the implications of that, he says something really quite beautiful. For as he talks not about Job in particular, but speaks generally of what life is about, he says in verses 11 to 15, see if you can pick up the thrust of what he's saying. Can papyrus grow tall when there is no marsh? Can reeds thrive without water? While still growing and uncut, they wither more quickly than grass. Such is the destiny of all who forget God, he says. So perishes the hope of the godless. What he trusts in is fragile. What he relies on is a spider's web. It's beautifully put. And is it not absolutely true? Look at the godless. Look at those who give no regard to God. What do you say about their security? They may be people who are full of confidence, but just scratch the surface a little bit. Work out where their confidence comes from. Work out what sort of security it is. You'll find, I think, in Australia at the moment, at least 90% of the time, that the person who is confident and secure and gives no regard for God, their confidence and security lies in a bank balance. You'll have to live in Australia for a couple more years, you'll see how shaky that is. Begin to see it anyway. But that's where their security lies. That will give them confidence. You'll see in our society that if you meet a person who's full of confidence and struts around the place, chances are they're wealthy. Not always the case. There are other things that make people confident. There are other equally fragile things that make people confident. But wealth is one thing that makes people confident. If you're wealthy, if you've been brought up in a wealthy family, if you've been spoon-fed all your life, I know a few people like that. Usually very confident people. But the confidence is based on something that is so fragile, it's like leaning against a spider's web, says Bildad. About as secure as that. Try and see how much a spider's web can support you sometimes. That's what their security is like. And isn't that true? Beautifully true statement he makes there. That's what their security is like. And then he applies it to the godly person. Pick it up in verse 20. Surely God does not reject a blameless man or strengthen the hands of evildoers. Do you think that the person who relies on God and lives a godly life, do you think that God forgets about that? Do you think God takes no notice of that, says Bildad? And of course, again, he's absolutely right. Well, there's his counsel. God is just. And he works out the implications of that. Well, again, Job is not terribly impressed. You see, in chapter 9, he responds, chapter 9, verse 2, I know this is true. Nothing new in that. to Job. And again, we'll look at that a little bit more next week. We'll see how Job's responses go. But our next speaker comes up in chapter 11. He's Zophar. The last of it. We're not going to have time to sing this song, I'm afraid. Give us a couple more minutes just to finish this discussion. This is the last speech we'll be looking at. Zophar speaks. The third of the friends. I think he's perhaps the least attractive of all of them. Zophar the Naamathite. And here he comes at chapter 11. He shows not one drop of compassion for Job, if you read carefully through his speech later on. He felt nothing of Job's agony. He just recites his theories about life. And he exaggerates. He caricatures Job and begins by scorning the poor man. 11 verse 2 says Zophar, "Are all these words to go unanswered?" Job's words he's talking about. "Is this talker to be vindicated? Will your idle talk reduce men to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock?" He goes on, verse 4. "You say to God, my beliefs are faultless, and I am pure in your sight." Job's actually never said any such thing, but nevertheless, that's the way he puts it. He accuses Job here of arrogance, but you read on and see that Zophar is quite sure that if God were to speak, that Zophar knows what he would say. "Oh, how I wish that God would speak," says Zophar, "that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom, for true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin." Well, even Zophar, this scorning, mocking Zophar, moves from that into what I suggest to you is a fine, true statement about the wisdom of God and the ignorance of stupid men. It comes up in verse 7. He says, "Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They're higher than the heavens. What can you do? They're deeper than the depths of the grave. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and wider than the sea." Go down to verse 12. "But a witless man, a stupid man, can no more become wise than a wild donkey's colt can be born a man." Fair degree of impossibility. Now, he is saying something profoundly true, is he not? That is, that human wisdom cannot fathom God. Don't think you can. And that's a truth that I think we ought to hear. How many times have you encountered that stupidity of the witless man? The witless man, the witless woman, who thinks that they can measure God by their intellect. How many times have you heard it? "I could not believe in a God who..." And then off it goes. "I could not believe in a God who does not measure up to my standards of what a God ought to be." What sort of stupidity is that? If God is there and if God is God, for goodness sake, don't start measuring him by your mind or mine. Do not think that we can be the measure of what God is. It's the other way around entirely. God is the measure of what we are. We cannot go around assessing and asserting what God must be for us to believe in him. What sort of nonsense is that? God is God and we acknowledge him. Not we measure him and tell him what he must be if we will be so gracious as to believe in him. No. Zophar's words are wise and they're true. And he proceeds to give his advice to Job at the end of the chapter. "If you devote your heart to him," he says in verse 13, "if you devote your heart to him, to God, and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that's in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then you will lift up your face without shame. You will stand firm and without fear. You will surely forget your trouble, recalling it only as water's gone by. Life will be brighter than noonday and darkness will be like morning. You'll be secure because there is hope. You will look around and you'll take your rest in safety." And so he goes on. He says, "Repent, Job, repent and all will be well." Okay, the three friends have now spoken, once each. Right through the rest of the book, they all have another go. Goes round and round again, and Job responds to them each time, and we won't have time in this series of studies to go through all the discussions. It's good reading. Read it through, and you probably have to take it in smallish doses because it's you get a little bit little involved after a while, but follow the discussion as much as you can as you read through. You'll see that the same sort of issues come up again and again, and the friends keep giving their advice, and Job keeps responding. Now, I want to take you to the end of the book, as we try and think about what we make of the advice that the friends have given. Go over to chapter 42. You may or may not know what happens between now and chapter 42. It doesn't matter for the moment. We'll see in subsequent weeks. But in chapter 42, God is speaking. And in verse 7, I just want to pick up the words. This is chapter 42, verse 7. God speaks to Eliphaz. Remember the first of the three friends that we've been looking at. And God says to Eliphaz, I'm angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now, what I want to ask is what was wrong with the advice of the friends? And suggest to you this. I'll make it quick. The problem with what they said was not that it was untrue, but that it was misapplied. The problem with it was that they knew some true things about God, and they were true things and important things. But they had the idea in their heads that because they understood some things about God, that they understood everything. They had the idea in their head that because they knew some true things about God, they fully understood God's ways on this particular occasion that confronted them. Their knowledge of God had led to a certain arrogance. Job, however, as we know, because we've read the first two chapters, Job hasn't read the first two chapters, but we have, and we know things that he doesn't know and the friends don't know. And we know that Job's problem is bigger than he can see or they can see. There are things going on behind the scenes that we mightn't fully understand ourselves, but there are things going on behind the scenes of life that start to explain what's happening to Job, but these friends they're incapable of touching upon. Yes, they have some true knowledge about God. They know some true things about God. But they've got the arrogance into their minds of thinking that that gives them the ability to interpret the particular situation in front of them with confidence, to know exactly what God is doing, to comprehend the ways of God like that. But there's another problem, a more subtle problem, I think, with the advice that the friends give to Job. For if you look carefully through the words that they say, you'll notice that each of them moves in a particular direction. We need to remember that last week, when we looked at chapters 1 and 2, the finest thing we learnt about Job was that Job trusted in God not simply for what he could get out of God. Not simply because he was experiencing kindness from God did he trust in God. He trusted in God because God was good. I said last week, I don't know how he knew that. We're not told how he knew that. Maybe he had a Bible. Maybe he had the rest of the Old Testament. Maybe he knew about what God had done in history. I don't know. But he did know it. He knew that God was good, and that even when his circumstances, when his suffering was crying out, God does not care, he knew that God was good and God could be trusted. Not as a means to an end. He did not trust God as a means to an end, but he trusted God in himself. Now, that was a great thing. Now, each of the friends come along, and do you see what each of them do? Each of them concentrates on his suffering. And each of them is giving him advice as to what to do to get rid of the suffering, to get rid of the trouble, to get rid of the pain, to get rid of the tragedy. Each of them encourages him, in other words, to look to God as a means to an end. We mustn't treat God as a means to an end. Now, there will be ends. There'll be consequences in your life and mine from our trusting God, and they'll be good consequences because God is good. But we don't approach God as a means to that end. God is so good that you love him for what he is. God is so good that you can trust him even when you can't understand what he's doing and you are not enjoying anything in life. Life can be painful, terribly painful. And you can find yourself in a situation when you can think of nothing in this world that you're enjoying. That can happen. I hope it doesn't happen too often to you, but it can happen. But even then, God is so good that he can be fully trusted even then. In the midst of suffering, we need to learn, and Job needs to learn, to trust God because God is good. Now, I've got three applications. I'll give them to you really quickly. Sorry, I've run a little over time tonight. Three applications, and I want to say them briefly. Because I say them briefly doesn't mean that they're not terribly, terribly important, and I want you to do the work yourself of thinking about how they apply to your own thinking and living. Three applications. The first one is this. Don't fall into a simplistic understanding of suffering. Don't think that when you encounter suffering, you can understand the ways of God and can interpret them. It's a very real problem, actually, in many Christian circles. You've heard about faith healing. Many things go by the name of faith healing, but most people who speak about faith healing, I think, have made this mistake. If I can say that cautiously, I'm sure there are people involved in faith healing who aren't making this mistake, but perhaps there are. But it seems to me those that I've encountered are making just this mistake. If you have enough faith, God will heal you. That kind of thing is said. And God deals with us in his own way, and we don't always understand what God is doing. Okay? What Job was learning, and what Job learnt to do, was to trust God whose ways he did not understand. That was Job's agony. To trust God when he did not understand God's ways, and when God did not relieve him. The second lesson is really the other side of that coin. And I've got a suspicion that for most of us here, this is the side that probably touches us more directly. Let's be careful not to fall into a simplistic understanding of prosperity. Let's not assume that all must be well between us